Voice of Reason Broadcast Network presents The Heretics Hour with Carolyn Yeager. Carolyn Yeager brings you news and commentary on Holocaust revisionism, World War II history, free speech issues, and more. And now, here's Carolyn.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. I have the privilege of welcoming once again Dr. Wilhelm Christman to my program. As you will recall, we did something of an overview of his wartime experiences in the March 15th program. Tonight, we're going to be discussing the events taking place in Austria during the 20s and 30s in more detail. Based on a memoir Dr. Christman has written in German, the title of his book is Als ich noch ein Lehrerbub war. Well, that's my attempt at saying it in German. It translates in English to When I Was a School Teacher's Son. If I'm wrong about that, I hope Dr. Christman will correct me. So, hello again to you, and thank you for agreeing to do another program with me.
Well, hello, Ms. Yeager. Thank you for taking me on again, and your German was perfect. It was very clear, and it proves that you are of German descent, so it's fine.
I did. Well, thank you. My goodness. You are very kind. I know that, because... It has to be kindness. All right, we're going to get started because there is so much for you to talk about. Your book is written in German, and I have a copy of it which you kindly sent to me, and it is a lovely little book, and it covers the years from, as you say on the cover of the book, 1925 to 1938. But I want to start in 1919 when you were born. Because that is when there was something of a revolution going on in Austria. And there was a great deal happening, and it affected you even as a newborn. So I would invite you now to start out and tell us that story.
Well, I was born October 1919. That was a year, about a year after the end of World War I. On November the 5th, 1918, the Republic of Austria was called up. And the president at that time was Dr. Renner, a social democrat, and his government announced the desire of joining Germany at first maybe in a loose union. That was announced on November the 5th. A month later, all of a sudden, in the southern part of Austria, in my home province, Carinthia, irredenta forces Slovenian entered the country and wanted to occupy it and secede it to the newly formed kingdom of Serbia, Croatia, and Slovenia.
And can you explain to the listeners what you mean by irredenta?
Well, those are forces, military forces, which are not officially acknowledged by their government, but they're getting together under some revolutionary leaders or chauvinistic leaders. And that was the purpose of this military forces, irredentis, to take away the two or three valleys beyond the border of the Kingdom of Serbia, because there were still some Slovenian minorities living there. That action immediately was answered by the provincial government of Carinthia to to call up home guards and fight against those invasions. And that happened at that time. After a short fighting of a few weeks, an armistice was settled and signed, and an allied commission was formed and visited the country. Well, that was already during the discussions of the treaty in Versailles and Saint-Germain, when the Allied powers forced Germany as well as Austria into signing a treaty which was very harsh on both countries.
Yes, and I'm going to interrupt you here because maybe you've moved past what I was hoping you would talk about a little bit, and that was that you were, as a baby, were taken across the Italian border for safety, and your father had to flee your village for a period of time. Is that correct? And how did that, tell us about that?
Yes, well, you know, after the first armistice, there was another invasion, and this time it was really under military Serbian leadership. It was a general mayor, and they invaded the country around early May 1919 and occupied the 2.5 or 3 valleys in the southern part. My father had to leave because there was no way for a German teacher to stay in this Slovenian or Serbian occupied area. My mother, however, stayed there and lived there with under the occupation powers. My uncle carried me over the mountains to my grandparents in northern part of Italy. That was also former Austria, which was seceded to Italy after the Saint-Germain Treaty.
Yes, and how old were you when you were carried across to your grandparents?
Was not quite a year old.
Oh, okay. All right. So you were already involved in quite a bit of activity.
When I was 6 years old, joining the grammar school, then at that time I was aware already what was going on in our valley and around the village, which was still, I think, mentally concerned about what happened in the 1919-1920 years. The plebiscite in October 1920 was very clear. It was I think it was all in all about 14,000 votes, and close to 23,000 were for the remaining of the valley in the province of Carinthia, and about 15,000 votes were against it. But 6 years later, 1925, when I entered the grammar school, which at the school where my father was director of the school, there were still remnants of that ill feeling at the time, and there was friction between the teacher and the German teacher and the priest who was more or less the head of the Slovenian minority in the village.
Yes. Tell us more about this this business of how the priests had the most influence in the village, or had quite a lot of influence in the village, and why, and why that was a problem for your people, your father.
Really,
who prefer German.
90% of the village people were Catholic and devote to the church. And the priest, therefore, has had quite a bit of influence, naturally, in his preaching and his services. On the other side, the grammar school, three classes, was naturally teaching German language and subjects of reading, writing, the basics of grammar school. But in the religious hours, the priest insisted on preaching the religion in Slovenian. And I still remember today, and I can quote it in the Slovenian language, the Our Father prayer. And that was naturally, well, those were built-in frictions between the teacher and the priest, and that went on through all the years. In it was never fierce, it was never didn't break out to any fights, but there was a hidden tension going on through all those years.
And why did most of the priests speak Slovenian? Were they Slavic?
No, that's an interesting question, because the bishop, I still remember his name, Adam Hefter, was a German bishop, but he realized that the priests in this mixed language area, it's 2.5 valleys, only could do a proper service if they're able to speak the dialect and language of the Slovenians. And by apparently education, those were then all chauvinistic Slavophiles and looking more over the mountains to the kingdom of the Serbs, Slovenes and Croatians than to the republic they were serving in.
I see. So I think what you mean is that the those who spoke, the Slovenians spoke both German and Slovenian, and most of the Germans spoke only German. Is that how it worked? And so if you were going to speak both languages...
You were pretty close to it. It was really not a pure Slovenian language. It was kind of a dialect. We called it Windisch, Windisch. And the people understand, for instance, our neighbor, she called me up when I was running for the train, when I was 14 years old, to pick up the train to my class in Klagenfurt. She spoke in a mixed German pidgin English, or pidgin German rather, with the Slavic impact.
Ah. Okay. All right. So what were your father's political views and how did he influence the family? You were telling me that it influenced actually even the names of you and your sisters.
Yes, well, my father was what we call in German a Nationaler, a national as a student already, when he went to the teachers' college, he joined a fraternity with the name of Armenia. Very indicating, because Armenia, well, you know, Arminius, the Teutonic leader of the Roman legions up there in northern Germany, well, half of the time, and all those fraternities, not all of them, but most of the fraternities at the college of at the teachers' college were nationals. Their names already indicated their preference: Normannen, Staufen, and Armenen. And that's how my father grew up. And well, he was an officer during World War I, was heavily wounded, and when he came home teaching in the grammar school there, he was very definite nationalistic and national, promoting the German language and well, defending, trying to defend his thinking against the influence of too much Slavics going on in the area.
Okay, and then you said it, it was reflected in the names of yourself and your two sisters, which I thought was very interesting.
Well, my name is not typically Austrian. Wilhelm Ludwig is really Hohenzollern and Wittelsbach. The German Kaiser was a Wilhelm, and the King of Bavaria was a Ludwig, and my two sisters were named after Valkyries, Gertrude and Gerhilde. We called them Trudy and Gerti. But those to a certain extent expressed my father's political and ideological background.
And your mother was a very strong-minded woman herself, although, she was
born in the village where I grew up and spoke both languages, but she was very, very on the side of my father and did not influence us too much as far as our upbringing in educational upbringing in history and geography was concerned. She was running really the household and was a very dearing female.
All right. And now you told me that when you were a student in school, I asked you if you planned to be a teacher too, like your father. You said yes, you did. And at that time, what was your thinking, and what subjects were you most interested in? And tell us more then about your school days and how you were thinking then. How your beliefs and your thoughts developed during that time.
Well, already in my 4 years at the grammar school, I was an avid reader. I mean, and I started reading early, and I remember my father had a monthly magazine which was called Germania, and here at right there was a picture magazine and descriptions of well, of ancient history of Teutonic. And there when I joined in the gymnasium, that's from 10 to 18, I was living in a boarding school, which was a special, or rather boarding institute, which housed about 60 students from 10 to 18. And among these 60 students, there were six sons of teachers. The rest were all students to become teachers. And they came from all over the country and housed in Klagenfurt, because the only college, teachers' college, was in Klagenfurt. And I grew up as a 10-year-old amongst this student corps, and there were already at that time with the older students were members of student fraternities, of three or different fraternities. There was also a union of Turnerbund, that's gymnastics, and there was a kind of union of students which were like wandering, traveling, and they called the migrating birds. And then there was also a student union called Nationalsozialistischer Schülerbund, NSS, and that was 1931, and I was a member of this NSS Schüler Union.
All right. And how did your beliefs not... Between 1925-6 and 1931, how did your beliefs fit in with the majority, or your father's beliefs? I mean, what was the general thinking in your part of Austria and in all of Austria at the time, as far as this German, pro-German idea?
At that time was, I like to get a little bit back to the Austro-Hungarian Empire, because the German people, about, I would say, 6.5 plus 3, 9, about 10 million German people were really the yeast and the binding group in the far-reaching Austro-Hungarian Empire. You know, we had in the North Bohemia, Moravia and Slovakia with 3.5 million Germans. Then we had in the southern part of Europe, Slovenia, Croatia, Dalmatia, we had the Hungary, and all that was kept together by a German bureaucracy administration. And when that broke out, the 6.5 million Germans in the Republic of Austria were faced with severe economic and political problems. And that caused...
You mean when the Austrian-Hungarian Empire came apart, was taken apart after the World War One, then the Germans were facing difficulties from the rest of the population? Is that what you're saying?
Well, it dissolved. It was economic problems, because all of a sudden in this small country of 6.5 million people, you had oversized industry. Textile industry was oversized, paper industry was oversized, lumber industry. On the other side, we didn't have enough factories to produce food. So we are depending, and that probably caused also the desire of joining the Greater Germany. And it was already publicly announced early 1919, and but then the Treaty of Saint-Germain was forbade that entering process.
So Austrians, with their small population now, and their economy, which was unbalanced, had to just struggle along as best it could. Correct?
Yes. Well, it was, you know, already very early there was strong unemployment there, so that pressed the political situation too. And then the government was most of the time formed by a coalition between the center Christian socialists and some splinter parties on the right side. But we had also a very strong social democrat Austro-Marxist party, close to, close between 30% and 40%. I was oscillating a little bit through all the years, but that was a strong opposition and caused frictions, political frictions.
Yes, and didn't you tell me that the Social Democratic Party of that time was not like the Social Democrats today? It was much more militant, more leftist, and more almost, was it, would you say it was vaguely communistic, or was it communistic, or?
No, not communistic, but militant Austro-Marxism.
Marxist, it was Marxist.
Yes, well, their leaders, you know, the Social Democratic Party of Austria goes back into the Empire times. I mean, there were Social Democrats leading after Marx and Engels. There was Kautsky, Adler, and Bauer leading socialists, which were leaders of the Austrian Social Democrats, and the Social Democratic Party also had a militant organization called the Republikanische Schutzbund, Republic
yes.
and Protection Union. And
that was a very militant organization, right?
Well, that was, we know that they had weapons, and they marched on May 1st always in their uniform. Now, vis-a-vis these leftist organizations, there were on the right side also militant organizations like the Heimatschutz and Heimatwehr. So there was a confrontation between the two always there existent. And it came then to the expected explosion. 1934, in February, the revolt of the Social Democrats, starting in Linz and then getting very, very heavy in Vienna.
Okay, all right, Dr. Christman, we have to take a break now. I'm sorry to interrupt you. We will pick up here when we come back. And ladies and gentlemen, we'll be back in just a few minutes, so stay tuned.
We'll be right back with more on the Heretics Hour. You're listening to VOR, ReasonRadioNetwork.com.
To discuss the consequences which followed the Second World War is Viktor Sukhodrev. He was the personal translator to Soviet leaders during the height of what became the Cold War. Welcome to our podium here today. Rather splendid view that we've got.
Thank you. It's a lovely view. I've been watching while you've been doing your stuff.
We're delighted to have you with us today, sir. Now, you've worked with many notable people, including Soviet diplomat Andrei Gromyko. Now, he previously, hadn't he, been involved in those complex talks about brokering what was going to happen after the war? The way Europe would look. Did he ever talk to you personally about how difficult those talks were?
Well, he did sometimes when we were, like when I traveled with him to, let's say, the United States or Great Britain, and we would have some free time and have a private lunch or breakfast even. He would sometimes recall that. But, I mean, Europe and the structure of what did become post-war Europe and the way it developed and changed was always uppermost in all of the discussions he had with European leaders, especially leaders of the United States, numerous secretaries of state, and numerous British foreign secretaries, because they changed, and Gromyko always stayed. So, but that was always one of the subjects, maybe the number one subject of any discussion he had with European leaders.
Now, Sukhodrev, as a linguist, you know more than most just how much can be lost in translations. So at talks such as those, such highly important talks, how important was it to get the tone right?
It was very important, and let me say that in my profession and at the level at which I work and my colleagues like myself, nothing is lost in translation. If it is, then the chap's out. I mean, the interpreter is out, never to come back.
Going back to Andrei Gromyko again, he was of course also the Soviet Union's ambassador to the US when the war ended. Did you ever get a picture from him that the Cold War was then in the air very much?
No, never. I mean, he never talked about that very much. No, and of course I came in, I began to work with Gromyko right after graduation from the university, and that was in 1956, and that was already the height of the Cold War. So I went through all the ups and downs, the really bitter periods of the Cold War, but also, and those were my favorite times, and also I went through the time of détente, for instance.
Let's return to the Heretics Hour, brought to you by VOR, ReasonRadioNetwork.com.
Mm-hmm.
Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen. This is Carolyn Yeager, and I'm talking to Dr. Wilhelm Christmann about the events in Austria in the 1930s. Before the break, he was telling us about the putsch. He began to tell us about the putsch by the Social Democrats in 1934, shortly after Adolf Hitler came to power in Germany in 1933. So please continue, Dr. Christmann, where you left off, if you can remember where you were.
Well, the Social Democrat started the putsch in February 1934. It started in the city of Linz, but it spread out to a big military event in Vienna. Vienna was controlled by the Social Democrat. It was a Social Democratic Bürgermeister, Mayor, and part of the city apartments were built like a fortress. And this is where the Republikanische Schutzbund, the militant arm of the Social Democrats, were defending and attacking and trying to tumble the government and take over. Well, it didn't happen. It was a bloody affair. There were, the Austrian army was engaged, and I think quite a bit over, I think over 100 people died and were killed in this military affair. There was also some militant bloody controversies going on and fights in the province of Styria and some industrial centers, Bruck and Leoben. But after nearly 2 weeks, the whole putsch was started. It was leaders
failed.
The leaders, some of the leaders fled to Czechoslovakia. Some were jailed and put into one of the first concentration camps in Lower Austria. That putsch in February was followed by a putsch of the National Socialists in July 1934. You can imagine here how upheaval the whole country was. And that was a putsch which started also in Vienna. A group of illegal SS men dressed up as police, Austrian police, stormed the federal chancellery where part of the government was assembled. They shot exchange of fire, revolver and rifle fire started, and the federal chancellor at that time, Dr. Dollfuss, was fatally wounded. The fight in Vienna was joined by fights in the provinces, primarily in Styria and Carinthia, but again that putsch of the National Socialists failed also. The Vienna upheaval was of a short limited time. The leaders of the SS group were caught and I think sentenced to death. I think two of them were hung. Some of the militant National Socialists in Carinthia and Styria fled to Yugoslavia, to a camp there, and then I think they were then moved to Austria. Well, that was 1934 to 1938. Those years were dark years for the National Socialists in the country and for a larger part of the nation also. Unemployment was strong. We lost some tourist business, primarily from Germany. The trade between Germany and Austria was cut short too. And towards the end of 1937, there were some efforts by the government, Dr. Shushnik, to settle or to clear some problems with the opposition parties. A minister was nominated, Dr. Saisin Kwart, who was responsible to smooth down the opposition and see that certain rights of writing and talking and forming would be accepted. Towards the end or early 1938, the Chancellor Shushnik was called to Berchtesgaden, to the Obersalzburg, to meet with Hitler in order to come to agreement, and the agreement was signed by Chancellor Shushnik that the opposition, specifically National Socialist, will have the right to form again the party and express and have their own press, have their own clubs and have their own party in action. When Shushnik returned after 2 days, I guess 3 days, he changed all of a sudden his decision and called for a plebiscite. And that turned the whole situation politically upside down. And there was tremendous pressure then from Germany. There was the realization, Shushnik, that Italy wouldn't help it, that help him, that the Allies, France and Great Britain wouldn't acknowledge his call. So he resigned, and the new government was already a National Socialist government in Austria, called Germany for help, and that is when the German army marched in under the jubilation of the people, and instead of any fighting there were flowers on the street, and the whole march from the border to Vienna was a kind of a festival between the people and the soldiers.
Yeah, and you know, so what is this business where they're always saying when Hitler invaded Austria, when Hitler invaded Austria, you know, that kind of terminology, where does that come from?
Well, there's plenty evidence that it was anything else but invasion. There are pictures of the hundred thousands of people in Vienna, and not only in Vienna, but on the way from the border through and along, there was nothing else but flowers and smiling and accepting and greetings.
And what were you doing at this time? Please tell us your own very personal experiences.
Well, I was on March the 12th or 11th. We got already a warning that said something is going to happen. Go and make...
Who did you get this warning from? And who
well,
was we?
That's from our underground Hitler youth leader in Klagenfurt. He said, go with your friends to the railway station and sit there and wait for further information. And the station master there, he was an illegal National Socialist too. So he was in the he was informed about that something might happen and some calls might come in. Well, it really the whole thing went so fast that we never got any special messages. It was on March 13th in the morning, where we knew already that German troops are marching into Austria, and we knew also that at the airfield in Klagenfurt, some Junkers 52 airplanes were landing. So we boarded the train. We were about six or seven people.
And how old were you now at this time?
I was 18 years old.
Okay, you're 18 now. All right.
Yeah, well, that was March March 38.
Mm-hmm. That's
was
right.
Not quite, it is 17 and a half.
Okay.
Well, after we returned from the field, we went home and jubilant next day, class started again. Our teacher, Dr. Carteris, was not there anymore.
What happened to him?
Huh?
What happened to your teacher?
My teacher, I think he resigned him on them, and he was so obvious involved in the with the Christian Social Party, and the last day when Schuschnigg announced his plebiscite, he had a flaming speech in the classroom, and next day there was no plebiscite, there was the Germans in Vienna, and the following days and weeks Austria became part of Germany. There was a plebiscite.
What happened in your classroom then when you were saying what happened when you got back in your classroom the next day?
Well, the teacher, our Latin and philosophy teacher, had a flaming speech on March 12th, where he said, well, we can do it if we want it, and Austria is going to be independent, and 24 hours later, that was all blue air, and Austria was part or becoming part of the Third Reich. And from then on, classroom naturally changed. There were, we had a different history teacher. We went into the final weeks of our eighth grade, and I graduated, I think it was early June 1938. Usually when you were 18 years old in Germany, at that time in Third Reich, you joined the Reichsarbeitsdienst for half a year. That's a voluntary working service. Female and males, girls and boys. The girls primarily helped farmers in their families during the summer months. The men, Arbeitsdienst, was working on streets, on dehydrating, so to speak, swamps, on forest cleaning. But I was, I didn't do that. I didn't have to do that because I was assigned to organize in my valley the Hitler Youth, 10 to 14 year old. That was called the Jungvolk, young people, and that's what I did from March to about August 1938. September 1938, I was then assigned to join a special group of Austrian Hitler Youth to the Reichsparteitag in Nuremberg. And we joined
the Reichsparteitag is the annual
day of the
National Socialist Party Day.
In Nuremberg in September 1938.
Yes.
And we took the train to Nuremberg and were housed in a big tent town outside the city. Pardon me. And the day of the Hitlerjugend march in the, at the Zeppelin meadow, that's where the big formations were marching by at Hitler, and we saw him very close and marched by, and watching then the performance of the army. The army had demonstrations of their marching units, and there were tanks doing their exercise, and then there were also some airplanes flying over the sky. After 2 days, we boarded our train again and came back home.
Okay, what was the mood when you were at the party day in Nuremberg?
Big enthusiasm, actually, and it was an adventure which cannot forget and won't forget about the 2 days in Nuremberg.
Okay. So when you came back home, it was September 1938, and what happened?
It was end of September in 1938, and I had already my call to services in drafted into the army for, well, my 2 soldier service, and I was called into barracks in Linz, Donau.
Yes.
But
before we go into that, I would like you to tell us about your sisters. I know that your sisters were also, yes, particularly one of your sisters.
Both my sisters served in the working service, and working for farmers. Trude was already at that time, she was 2 years younger than I am, and she served, did her half year stunt at the farmhouse in Carinthia. Gertie, my younger sisters, did that during the war, so they were both involved in the Reichsarbeitsdienst, and Trude later became teacher. And after the war, 1939, early 1940, she became then the leader of the Bund Deutscher Mädel, that's the female or the girls organization of the Hitler Youth in the new region of northern Slovenia. And she did that until the end of the war.
Okay, and what was your mother doing during this time? And your father?
My mother helped out, you know, there were some organizations helping the sick and the families who had a lot of children. And that was kind of supporting agencies within the party. And my mother did that in her village.
Okay, and what was your father... What was your father doing at this time?
Well, my father was still teaching, but he was also in the village at the mayor's office. He took over the organization office. I mean, I think they had kind of a union of farmers union, the workers union, all the paperwork involved in this organization has to be done by somebody, and my father took that over. It was partly also the party organizations, and my father became, I think, early in the war, then a member of the party.
Dr. Christman, I'd like to ask you, as you experienced it at the time in your family, what were the general feelings of the Austrian people, or, well, that's the best way I can put it, after the Anschluss, and what kind of, was there a lot of enthusiasm? How many unhappy people were there, or dissidents, because so many people afterwards and nowadays want to express how unhappy the Austrians were with National Socialism. Later on, of course, after the war had been going on for a long time. But what was the mood? And how would you say? I know, of course, the plebiscite was 98% for Adolf Hitler. So what was? And you didn't you tell me that you also met him a second time somewhere in Austria?
Well, you know, the plebiscite was yes or no for the Anschluss, and it was 99% yes. I couldn't vote because I was still underage, because voting age at that time was 21. You could only vote when you reached the age of 21. But there was general super optimism. I mean, they knew, well, within a very short time, the 4 or 5 months I lived in my home village before I joined the army, the whole village was, even though we know that there were a lot of social democrats, the majority of the people were social democrats, but everybody expected big changes as far as the economy is concerned, as far as, and there were right away, I think already in the first months, entrepreneur and industrialist from Germany came in and bought the factory. We had a big steel factory in our village, which was idled down and closed already in 1936. And he started, and I think when I left, it was already the beginning of coming machinery in for a battery factory, and I think the same year, either early 39 or already late 38, the battery factory in our village started, and employment was there and optimism was there, and there were to my knowledge even the social democrats or even the clerical people, they were all looked forward to better times within the Third Reich.
Okay, and were there SS personnel stationed around in Austria? Were there Wehrmacht personnel? And if there were, how did they behave?
Oh, yes. Well, naturally, there were in Klagenfurt, for instance, the barracks there were occupied by German troops, German Wehrmacht in Wehrmacht uniform. I was, before I joined the Luftwaffe, I was checked out by former Austrian officers in the new German army uniforms, and naturally everything was taken over by the German administration in the political field, and in the military field that the German army took over.
But it was everybody was behaving well, and
but there was no disturbance whatsoever. I remember that the mayor of our village was a social democrat, Muden, and he was the head of the militant group of the Republican Schutzbund. He was taken into protective custody in, I think, early April, and was sent to Dachau. And in June, early July, he came back. I didn't talk to him personally, but I talked to his daughter, and she said that after interviewing and after some weeks detention there, he was released and came back home and lived his life there.
All right. Well, Dr. Christman, this has been very enjoyable for me and very enlightening for our listeners, I'm sure. Our time has run out. I want to thank you very much for agreeing to appear with me again today. And I'm extending an invitation already for you to come back so we can talk about more about your time in the Wehrmacht and also the time that you spent in the camps after the war. I really want to go into that in more detail. Would you be willing to do that?
Well, thank you for having me. Naturally, I would like to be again with you whenever you call me, and appreciate your time giving me to express myself. Thank you.
Well, it's our pleasure. Thank you very much. So, ladies and gentlemen, that's all for tonight. I hope you'll tune in again next week. Good night.
Thanks for listening. The Heretics Hour returns Monday evening, 9 p.m. Eastern U.S. time. Join us at ReasonRadioNetwork.com.